Hello there.
Hold on, Bob. Good evening. A little bit of technical difficulties here. We're pleased to welcome you to the Métis Voices Radio once again, our own internet radio program at the BBS Radio every Friday evening, 7:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Station 2 with your host, Dale Haggerty, live from the Machif Métis Museum in beautiful Vavenby, B.C., Canada. You can find the museum website at www.machifmetismuseum.org. Our program features a variety of subjects and special guests each week. Call-in lines are now open, as well as a chat feature for your questions and comments. Here are the numbers to call. In the U.S. and Canada, toll-free 888-228-4494. And worldwide, toll-free 877-489-6350. For direct lines, go to the www.bbsradio.com, BBS Station 2 on the right-hand side. Those who wish to enter the BBS live chat rooms, you now need to access it by the homepage of BBS Radio. Go to the left-hand side, scroll down, and click into How to Listen. Then scroll down to Chat Live, BBS My Chat Rooms. Click in, choose the drop-down menu, select the chat room chatter hall. Sign in if already registered or register if not. And now, Dale Haggerty.
Let's say, everyone, welcome this Friday, June the 27th, to our Métis Voices radio program. Tonight, I have the privilege of introducing you to my guest, our good friend, veteran Métis brother, Bob Ducharme, president of the Métis Veterans Association of BC. Welcome to our show, Bob.
Well, thank you.
Well, how are you tonight?
I am terrific.
Good. And how's the weather on the island?
Oh, it's very nice. We had a beautiful day, nice and warm, and we like to keep it that way.
There you go. Well, to start out the program, can you tell us a little bit more about where you lived and growing up in your family life? Did you grow up in a Métis community?
Yes, I did. I was born and raised in a place called Craig Siding, Manitoba. It's about 40 miles east of Winnipeg on the main line CNR. And now they've got a highway going through there. And one day it's going to have blacktop. But in any case, I was born there in 1933, and I saw the advent of new roads coming in for some of the old trucks that were on the roads in those days, and sleighs and horses and wagons and you name it. There was a predominant figure of Métis people around the area, and they were some of the leftovers from helping the CNR to get through and carving wood ties out of some of the most beautiful resilient pine in all of North America. And they were shipping it all over the place wherever a railroad was being built. They were shipping these railway ties all over. And incidentally, of note, I just thought of it, one of the people that was a famous person that was working in the tie cutting camp was Don Messer for a year. He was a friend of my dad's. So
wow.
That was a long time ago. And then from that, he was one of the guys that was a real Métis fiddler, and one of the best, still is the well, he's not being equaled by very many people, but was Andy DeJarlis. Andy, I can remember sitting behind the stove as a little kid and listening to him play all Saturday night till 7, 8, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. But anyways, we grew up in a big family, and let's see now, I think we had 11 people and 11 sisters and brothers and in my family, and no TV. We didn't even have a radio until after the war, and so it was all work and no play.
Yeah. Well, Bob, tell us about, you know, you have a large family. Is it the reason why you didn't have any TV? Is that the reason why you had a large family, your parents?
Well, that's the standard joke back there in those days, the people that have grown up in that era. But got to remember, we didn't even have electricity in those days. I think that, generally speaking, the large families were a result of a lot of good, solid workmanship, and people wanting to have families, and people wanting to make a mark in the world by having offspring learn and work and grow up and be affluent in our society. We always tried to achieve that, but not always succeeded, though.
Yeah. Well, another reason why they had large families, as well as the idea is they were also trying to expand the country and the population as well. As well as there was probably lots of work on the farm that, you know, that they could, that they needed all that extra help for, eh?
So. Well, that's a very good point, Dale. Many of the people wanted to expand their families because there was a need for workers in a lot of different areas, because of the fact that little towns and industries and et cetera, were very sparsely placed all over the place. And so it's, like, for instance, when I was cutting pulpwood from age 13, we were sending the pulpwood in boxcars all the way around through Winnipeg and back to Pine Falls on another railway. And then after a while, we ended up cutting pulpwood because the cord got a little more expensive, and we could get 25 cents a cord more for pulpwood if we sent it to Abitibi Pulp and Paper in Dryden, Ontario. So that was a lot of traveling, but everybody had a little bit of trick to do things like that. The longer it traveled on the railway track, the more packed the pulpwood got, and by the time it reached the far end, 8 feet of pulpwood in a boxcar came down to about 7'4", 7'5", or 6". So you lost pretty near a quarter of a cord on the scale when they took it out at the other end. So, anyways, you were always on the lookout for these things, but
yeah.
We didn't learn too fast. And when you're busy cutting pulpwood with a sweet saw and an axe, we didn't have chainsaws in those days.
Yeah,
I can remember when I was about 17 years old, I heard of this guy that. Well, one of his ambitions, he was in the strip next to me where I hung up my chain, my sweet saw and axe when I went to join the Army. This guy had an ambition of his own, that he was going to cut enough pulp to buy himself a chainsaw one day.
Wow. There you go. Was there a lot of work in there for Did you have a problem when you, as being Métis, getting work? Did they discriminate at that time, or was? I knew that from what I've understood. I heard Métis men in the early days. They were known to be some of the best workers that.
Cutting wood, cutting cordwood, cutting pulpwood, boxwood, whatever, or the logs. The Métis people made some of the best workers because they worked together quite well, and they worked all across Canada. In fact, I had occasion just to help with the searching for history for the local bastion Hudson Bay Fort here in Nanaimo, and I found out that there was two Métis people that were hired to do the broad axe work for the timbers that made up the bastion, which is still standing, and it's still got the original timbers. And 2 years ago, I met a guy in Kelowna who said his great-grandfather was one of the people that that helped with the broad axe work, cutting out the timbers, flattening out the sides of the timbers for the bastion. And I lost his name, and I wish I could find out again, because the people here in Nanaimo Historical Society are trying to find this guy. So maybe
sure
one
those,
of your listeners
I'm,
will know.
Yeah, well, maybe that's what I'm hoping to. If there is any listeners out there that that knows the little bit of history of the Fort in Nanaimo, what was the name of it? Was it called Fort Nanaimo, or was it? Do you know, or was there?
It was Fort Nanaimo, yeah.
Oh, okay,
but it was put on by the Hudson Bay Company, and it was the Hudson Bay Fort.
Now, I've been to Nanaimo. Whereabouts is it now? Because, you know, it's...
Well, it's right downtown. All roads, all streets lead to the fort from Nanaimo. The streets are kind of fan-shaped down to the waterfront.
Yeah, okay.
The center is this fort. In fact, I trained the bastion guard that fires the cannon for every noon hour and tourist season. I don't do it now, but I originally trained them in 1985.
So now that's where you're living now is on the island in Nanaimo, British Columbia.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, that's where you're living now, and it's a large community, a Métis community in the area, do you?
Well, there's a lot of different, I think there's about three or four different Métis organizations here, and many of them are vying for some kind of position to try and get some government help, and it seems to me that we all suffer from the same thing. We have a lot of ideas, and then somebody comes along and cuts us off at the pass. So it's nothing new. Nothing new to us. Métis are good people.
Yeah, that's right, you know. I mean, getting back to the Métis and our ideas, the Battle of Batoche, the Trench Wars, didn't one nation steal that from us? In the First World War, weren't they using trench wars after they found out the examples of how, our ancestors held a group of soldiers for so many days? So
yeah.
So there's some ideas there. even the way
that was
the
a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's right too. So
yeah.
So what are you doing now? You're a veteran, right? Tell us a little bit about.
Well, I joined the army. I left Craig's Hiding. I was working on the extra gang, and then I I was on the CNR, and then I left them in Atacocan, Ontario, about the end of October of 1951, and I was had my papers in all ready to join the RCMP. And anyways, I had a friend that was in charge of the detachment in Beauséjour, and he was a sergeant, and one of the best, really. And anyways, I was going to join. I'd done all my tests and all that, and was sent to Ottawa. In those days, everything went to Ottawa for clearance. And I was waiting. So anyways, I got a job back in the Poplewood camp again, and working there and until about the 9th of January of 1952. I wasn't making very much money, and it was getting awful cold, and my dad and I had walked out each morning and walked back each evening approximately 12 miles each way to go and cut pulpwood. And one morning where I had a gallon can full of tea where I had boiled, and about 10:30 we were having a bannock sandwich and got some hot tea, and my dad asked me, he said, what are you going to do with your life, Bob? So I said, I'm joining the RCMP, as you know. He said, yeah, but you haven't heard anything from them. And I thought, well, maybe I better start doing something else. So I had a couple of other friends who were in the Army, and a couple in the Air Force, some in the Navy that grew up in my hometown. And so anyways, I said, look it, after the coffee tea break was over, I took my axe and I reached up as far as I could on this one tree in this strip of land that I had for pulpwood. And I hung my saw on it, and incidentally, it's still sitting there today, one lone spruce tree in the middle of the prairie. It's all rusted out. But I left it there, walked out, and walked up to Vivian, Manitoba, which was where the highway was, and I got a ride on a truck into Winnipeg. I went and I joined the Army, and on the that was on the 10th, and on the 11th, I was called in to, and I got sworn in. And, anyways, I, done my basic training, I finished my basic training. After, 3 weeks, they give you a 7 days leave in order to get any administration that you have at home, getting it straightened out so that you, if you leave in a hurry, everything is all taken care of. So anyways, but if you come back into the camp in any of that time, during that time that you're on leave, you confiscate your leave. So anyways, I got home on a Friday night, late, and the first thing, getting in the door, my mom handed me this brown envelope. And I ripped it open. It was from Ottawa. It was my acceptance in the RCMP. So anyways, boy, I was happy for the weekend. And then Sunday afternoon, I got into the, on the bus. I had to walk to the bus again and, to the highway, and got on the bus, came back into camp and forfeited the rest of my leave. And, I got marched up in front of the sergeant major, and the sergeant major, marched me in front of the major, the company commander, and I had this paper, this letter, and of acceptance, and I told the company commander, I said, sir, I said, I'm not going to be here very long. Why? I said, well, here, he read the letter, and he started smiling, and he said, he says, you know what? He says, you, my friend, have picked one of the finest police forces in the world. And coming from him, a Second World War vet, I thought that was really special. So anyways, I was getting excited there after about 20 minutes of him building up the RCMP and everything else. And then I said, well, I gotta leave. But he says, well, not so fast, you know, soldier. I said, why, sir? I says, I got to turn in all my gear. He says, not so fast. He says, you got a 3-year contract with us. So that's what happened.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway.
Go for it. Yeah, that's...
I went to Korea, and I ended up going to Korea, but I was told by the personnel selection officer that I would be going to Germany, but I ended up going to Korea first, and it wasn't all a bed of roses, but we'd done a lot of things that kept us busy, and I saw the tail end of the fighting, and we come back, and went to Germany for 3 years, and Cyprus a couple of times, and various other places. And consequently, I met a lot of nice people in my lifetime, and I'm continuing to this day to meet nice people. But there are some that aren't so nice, but that's another story.
Yeah. How many years did you spend in this service?
Oh, I just had 20 years.
20 years for a person that just wants to go in there for a weekend pass. That's a long time. Oh, that's quite a career, though, 20 years. So, congratulations on that.
Thanks. I met a lot of nice people who learned a lot of good things, like a lot of the Army taught me a lot of discipline and I come from a family that, you know, we look to work hard and not entirely very personable, mostly pretty shy and just do your job. But anyways, I learned to accept friendship, etc. And I later I met a young lady in Victoria just before I went to Germany, and this beautiful young girl became my wife, and we got married in England, actually. She quit her job in Victoria and came and joined me in Germany, and we got married in the same church as her mom and dad got married. So we had one daughter in Germany, and then another one in Calgary, and then a son in Calgary, and that's the end of our family. And later on, we've had a very good life together, and we just celebrated our 50th anniversary here just on the 9th of May.
Oh, congratulations on that.
Thank you. So,
listen, Bob, did you have the privilege of meeting our most decorated soldier there,
Tommy Prince?
Yeah.
Tommy
did
Prince?
Did you have the chance to meet him? And
actually, I did. After the Second World War, my grandmother, who was a Cree, who was born in York Factory, was out with us, like, during the summertime. When I grew up, all the families, if you didn't have a job on the railway track or a permanent job, you went out picking blueberries, and that was a good way, and then a little later, Seneca Root. But we were picking blueberries in a place called Telfer, Manitoba, just by Rennie, just on old number 4 highway, and they still pick blueberries there. But I remember looking after my grandmother while the rest of my family was, and I was only a little young guy at that time, but I can remember her talking with this native fellow, and he had a big smile and a very infectious laugh, and he was talking with her in her own tongue, you know, and I wondered, you know, I couldn't understand it, but they were getting along really well, laughing and joking, and I was looking after the billy can with the tea in it and bringing them tea all day sort of thing, you know. But anyways, Tommy Prince knew some of my uncles in the war, and then later on I met him when I joined the Army. I met him in Winnipeg because I joined up with another fellow by the name of Prince. His name was Bernie. He was a nephew to Tommy. And Tommy was, we all met, and I can remember the one Saturday afternoon. It was about the latter part of March of 1952. And there was a whole bunch of us. There was a guy by the name of Laramie, Billy Daniels, Doug Godet, a whole bunch of Gibosh, and but anyway, a whole bunch of Métis guys, and we were all met at the place called the, on North Main, called the Seymour. We used to joke about that, Seymour at the Seymour. There was lots of stuff going on there. But I met Tommy in, Tommy has just come back from Korea for the second time. So, at that time we didn't know he was just a forgotten soldier at that time, having trouble with some of the elements in the city of Winnipeg, North Main. And, of course, you know, we, at one point he was denied access into his own reserve, at Pegwas Reserve, where he came from. And they'd kick him out of there, and then they wouldn't accept him back from the RCMP or from the police, and where he'd come back for a beer, coke too much for the evening, and he'd end up going back to North Main and with all his friends, and until he got drunk again. And it was an awful set of circumstances. And this is one of the reasons that I am involved with the veterans now. I search out not only Métis veterans, but Aboriginal veterans also.
Yeah.
Because I've still got about, right now I've got about half a dozen names that I'm working with right now, that people that haven't had any help after the war.
Did our veterans? Now I heard stories from my mom and my uncle about our great uncles and that were in the First World War, and you know, and
right.
when they came back from the First World War, they were treated pretty terrible, and you know, they would give them their final pay and then a bus ticket wherever they needed to go, and that was the end of it for them, you know. And
that's correct.
I don't know. Was this a common practice for our servicemen, for Aboriginal? Talking First Nation.
Well,
and
it's a common practice, but because of the Aboriginal and the Métis people coming back from the war, wanting to get back to the trap lines or to the bush camps or farms or wherever they came from, fishing villages, trap lines, that's the only thing they knew before they went into the Army, and some of them never had any schooling, so they wanted to get back there. That was the only thing that they could resort to make any money at. So once they went back, they were kind of forgotten about, and not purposely, but because Veterans Affairs have tried to search out some of these people. And you got to remember, I've heard stories where people have, you know, they didn't know what an envelope was that came in the mail. It was a brown envelope and it had a bunch of writing on it. They couldn't read it, and they didn't want to let on to anybody else they couldn't read because of their pride and esteem. So they just crumple it up and throw it in the old tin stove and start a fire with it to make their breakfast or their meal, boil their kettle. favorite story is the big strapping guy. He passed away here 2 or 3 years ago. He was from northern Alberta, and he was telling me in 1939 when he heard the war was going on and they needed people, he took his canoe and he paddled for 12 days going in from where he was in northern Alberta. And he got into the city of Edmonton, joined the Loyal Edmonton regiment, and he put his boat or his canoe, he turned it upside down on a wood pile and put a canvas over it in the backyard of his brother-in-law in Edmonton. But where he come from, they never had any schools or anything. So he went to war, and he came back, got his canoe, paddled back home again after a couple of bucks in his pocket. And then pretty soon, I think it was around the early 50s, they decided to have a patrol go through of RCMP, RCMP. And so one constable would go once a week and search out whatever, take notes or whatever. And they were well liked. And so anyways, old Archie, there wasn't very many people who knew very much about English, but Archie did, and so he could interpret. So they got him as interpreter, and every time they got him, they paid him, give him a little check, and that was it. So anyways, pretty soon there was 2 or 3 people come out, and then they started the detachment there with a couple of RCMP officers and put in a building, and then they had a corporal in charge of it, and they kept Archie on as a special constable for expressly this purpose, help with the natives. And old Archie done very well. It came 25 years, and he was eligible for a pension from the RCMP. So he was called in, and by this time the sergeant was commanding the little detachment there, and he said, Archie, he said, I'm going to send you to Edmonton to see this corporal so-and-so, and he's going to set you up for your pension. And Archie said, well, what's that? So he said, well, we give you money for once a month for the service that you provided us. And okay. So away he went to Edmonton for a couple of days and met this corporal. The corporal interviewed him, and he said to him, he says, I got to have some figures to put down here. So what, how much are you getting for your wounds that you got in the war from the Army? And Archie says, what do you mean? He says, well, he says, you've been wounded, don't you get anything for it? He says, no, I don't get anything. So he says, oh, we'll fix that up. So anyways, the corporal searched, and he got some addresses, and he wrote some letters, and he got Archie a disability pension. So Archie was doing well, and as he was going around from little town to little town, meeting his friends, now he was retired. So he was telling all his old Army buddies and service buddies that he was getting a pension. They were saying, what's that? So anyways, he started the ball rolling, the other people start putting in for pensions and getting them. Some didn't, some did. And there's a lot of different requirements, but the rest is history. And until we just came into a lull here just about 5 or 6 years ago, and we are still finding people that are eligible, and we're also looking not only for veterans of Métis descent, but we're also looking for surviving spouses, because we realize that some of the veterans have passed away or have gone on, and we're looking for surviving spouses to help pay them a benefit, which we still have to convince the government about, and or the estate, in case of there's no surviving spouse. So that's what I'm doing.
Wow. So you're the president of the Métis Veterans Association of British Columbia. Tell us
tell us a little bit about your goals
and how it was started. And I know you right now you've been telling us the dedication that you're doing right now to help our veterans to get pensions and stuff. But give us some more details. What you're up to?
Well, okay. Well, the Métis Veterans is kind of an offshoot of the National Aboriginal Veterans Association, as I'm led to believe, that went after a benefits clause for the Aboriginal veterans, and they got them in the government's qualifying points are that you must, one of them is that you must live on a reserve. Well, if you're a Métis, most of the people didn't live in a reserve, although, and this is under wrong, because just a couple of months ago I met a guy from Victoria who still lives on a reserve out there, and he is a Métis, and we're putting his name in for this benefit because the Veterans Affairs told us that there's absolutely no Métis that lives on a reserve, so according to their records. But we found one, and I've since found another one here just phoned me up just yesterday from a place in Nova Scotia. But these are people, like when we talk about Métis, we're talking about Métis from the homeland who are in the western provinces. But the Métis Veterans Association, as I mentioned, were an offshoot because they it was felt at that time that they were kind of left hanging out to dry from the by the government and the National Aboriginal Veterans. But, you know, I don't know that history, and I don't want to dwell on it because I do have a lot of faith in a lot of people, both on the government side and the Aboriginal veterans. I still process Aboriginal veterans for pensions and benefits. But these guys decided to form their own National Métis Veterans Association, and we had some growing pains there, and when I got involved, and I found out that some of the things that were going on was not necessarily very honest in some cases, and so myself and a couple of others pulled out, and we formed our own provincial organizations, and this is what we're doing now, and in the hopes that one day we'll get back into a national association, but who knows. But when we formed our own provincial associations, we had some interest from some of the, in my case, we had some interest from the local provincial Métis Federation, and to kind of help us out. And there's a lot of people, a lot of Métis people that are very staunch supporters of the Métis veterans here in BC and around the country. However, since joining in an alignment agreement, I didn't necessarily want to join and be under control of anybody, which is a good thing because we found that we were starting to get manipulated, and because of money, and consequently, we're on our own again, and so we're still trying, and as long as we keep things honest and above board and transparent, we hope to go a lot further with our association and help the real veterans in BC and in Canada. So that's just about the intent of what we are doing. Right now, I've got about 130 people that who are members, and it's growing pretty well every day. We get one or two or three or people every day to join, qualify, and thank God we put in a we got computers now because it makes it a lot easier for us.
Now tell us, Bob, did when you're a veteran of an association, have you got associate members? Which, like, for example, if for example, my father was Scottish, for other
yes,
examples,
as a matter of fact, we do, yeah.
Yeah,
we do. We have a membership clause that if a person is let's just say, for example, you had a grandfather in the First World War, Second World War, or Korea, and he was he's no longer here, and you wish to put his name in for benefits or work on those benefits on his on the strength of his career, because that's what the Veterans Affairs and Canadian government have since bought for the Aboriginal veterans, and I don't see them denying that to us once we get our house in order. But we do have a system that takes them on as members, and the people who will benefit from it is either the surviving spouse or the estate. So, but we do have another clause, which is honorary members, which is friends of the association, or like people who are not necessarily Métis, but they have shown cause that they want to help our cause, and so we reward them with an honorary membership, although we've got three members like that already, and it depends on the circumstances whether they become an honorary member or not. Some just because we don't want too many honorary members. We just, you know, enough to a lot of people like you know, are very good and handy with various government projects and stuff like that. And we'll take them on, or got something that maybe they want to offer to aid us in our struggle from day to day.
I was a member of the veterans, the NAVA, which is the National Veterans Association, as an associate member. And the only reason why we got involved in the association is because we thought it was our duty as Métis, not a veteran, but as a Métis person, to help our Métis people. For example, I was designated to carry the flag for them. I'm a Métis, proud Métis person, and he says, Dale, would you be the honor of, because some of our veterans can now, they can't be carrying the flags now because of their age, and we got to take care of them, men are in colors, and but would you carry the flag on our behalf? And I was very much as privileged to be honored to do that, and that's the extent that my end of what it was only to honor our veterans by carrying the flag for them because they couldn't carry them themselves, because, you know, the poles were heavy and the flags were flying.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, for sure.
You know, and I used, like I said, I know we have a very sweet Métis elder veteran, Teresa Dion, which I used to always take to the events, and she was always in the grand entry, and again, she says, Dale, I can't carry the flag. Would you carry the flag on our behalf? And and I would do this for them. So
well, right now,
and
for myself, I don't, Go ahead.
I think this is a very honorable thing for our Métis youth to do this for our veterans, because it shows our respect for the veterans that they went to war to fight for us, for our future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyways, that's a very good analogy of the whole thing, Dale, and I'm glad you feel that way about it, because it makes me feel that important that if I am not training, I train and handle flag parties for a lot of different things, and there's a certain amount of pride that goes along with the carrying of flags, and because it represents who you are, and it shows me that it's not in vain. One day I'll be hopefully meet Teresa Dion, because I've heard a lot about her, and a lot of good things, as a matter of fact. And there's another person I hope to meet who was in the Second World War in the Quacks also, that I hope her and Teresa meet together one day. And this lady, I remember as a kid, I used to get up in the morning in Manitoba, in Winnipeg, or east of Winnipeg, where I was born and raised. At 6 o'clock in the morning, I would be finished feeding the horses and that, and come in and turn the radio on when I had one. After the war, we had one, an old Crosley. And I'd listen to CJOB, and I'd listen to this. Tucson was called Sleepy in Swede. And this girl with a terrifically strong but beautiful voice used to play the guitar and sing as a special guest on the Sleepy in Swede show. And that girl still plays and sings the guitar, plays the guitar and sings in Port Alberni, and her name is Jessie Spence. And I just had a talk with her again here about a week ago. And
oh.
So I'm looking forward for her to play the fiddle for me and play the guitar and sing.
There you go.
I hope to have her record for me, because I play the fiddle myself.
Oh, there you go. There
yeah.
you go. Were there a lot of Métis that served in the forces in the past and now in the present?
From what I'm gathering, I see a lot of people that were very reluctant to say that they were Métis, but just, like, it wasn't until about 1978 that I really knew that I was a Métis. It was always, we were always a half-breed before that, and all the people that I knew when I got out in 71, it was, we were known as half-breeds. And half-breeds, you know, or Métis, so anyways, it was changed to Métis, and a lot of people didn't really, make too much of a commotion over that. They just accepted it, but there's a lot of people that I know nowadays that I met in the services over the period of time that they are in fact Métis and are searching their roots and genealogy and were coming up very positive. So I would venture to say that there's probably about, of the service people that I served with, or in Canadian services, Canadian forces in my time, there was probably around about 60% to 75% which
wow.
had a Métis background. There's still a lot of research going on.
There's somebody on the call on the line there. Can you give us your name?
Yeah, Derek.
Hi, Derek. Welcome to the show. Have you got a question for Bob?
Yeah, I actually want to tell Bob a story. Dale knows all about this. A couple of years ago, I was asked by the Legion. I was very honored to carry our Métis flag for the very first time in the Color Guard. And we actually carried two Métis flags, one in the front and one in the back. And I was actually very honored to walk with the Color Guard themselves. And we didn't have a flag availability. Teresa Dion was supposed to be at that particular Legion, at the Wally Legion. She got called away to replace somebody else that could not make it. So she was at the other Legion up in White Rock. So I carried the flag to represent my family, because my grandfather was in the military, my uncle was in the military, he was a helicopter pilot, and according to the Legion, the staff sergeant said to me that not too often anyone is able to walk with the color guard unless you are in the military yourself. So I was quite honored when I basically walked with our Métis flag, and it was very heart-wrenching for me because it's an experience I'll never forget in my life. And I stood with the color guard. I mean, I'm going to share something with you. I'm not sure if you know a fellow by the name of Ken Fisher, but he caused a bit of a ruckus with us, telling me that I had no right to carry the flag, and this is when we were still standing in the rain at the time, and he was causing a little bit of a riff, and I told Ken to back off, you know, leave it alone until this is over, and he wouldn't quit. We end up going having a meeting with the Legion, the Wall Legion Feet people, and they were quite shocked that Ken Fisher sort of disrupted it, and they were quite upset, and they just told Ken, you cannot ever do that ever again. But I was trying to get other elders, veterans, to carry the flag, but at the time, most of them couldn't even walk. And so I didn't want to see it non-existent to the point where there's no veterans able to walk with the color guard. So I just thought I wanted to share that with you.
Well, I think that's that is very very nice and respectable attitude of yours, Derek. And I compliment you for your actions. Business with Ken Fisher, I heard about, because in fact I still got a letter on file here that he asked me to look into, which I didn't. I couldn't. I found some evidence in the letter that I really didn't agree with. And but anyways, I thought he was out to lunch on that one, and I still think he is. And because if you're allowed to carry the flag in the color party, you know, it's a gesture of goodwill, and it's honoring the veterans that you stand for. It's not providing any chest puffing for the sergeant at arms. It's his job just to command it, and the flag party and or color party in the Legions, and if anybody comes along wants to carry a flag on behalf of some organization or some thing, they should be honored.
Yeah.
It's simple.
The thing is, like, he got upset that he was never asked, well, and he kept saying, well, there are Métis elders here, and there is a one of the ladies who was a veteran, and she was there, and she supported me because she was part of this as well. She, right now, as we speak, she's got breast cancer and lung cancer, so our prayer's out for her. But she supported us 100% and for what was happening. And like I said before, the issue was never finished. It was never completed. It was never... they just basically said, if this ever happens again, that the Métis will never, ever walk with the color guard ever again. And that's one thing that Ken Fisher was trying to disrupt. And he's trying to bring someone else in as an elder, saying that I wasn't Métis enough, and I wasn't...
Yeah, well, I kind of sense that, because they even got
the name of
the person.
I kept saying to Ken, but I'm registered with you. I'm actually on your files. And he goes, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. I got your card. And he kept saying, you're not that Métis enough. And like, he was, and so I found out after, he was choked that he was not in the color guard. He was never asked. And then he said he was a veteran. And I talked to another elder veteran. He told me that Ken Fisher's never been a veteran.
No.
That he was in the Navy, or Secret, or something like that.
He had an uncle that I knew very well with NAVA, and ex-Navy guy and a prince of a guy.
Yeah.
George Fisher. He was a real, real nice guy.
Yeah.
And if he ever saw something like that like going over, going off, he would have taken them over his knee and given them a spanking.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Derek, for your call. I really appreciate this.
Thanks Derek.
For your story there. That's
yeah, I wanted to share that with you.
Out the air there, so yeah.
Thanks for letting me.
Yeah, thanks, Derek.
Yeah, Derek might want to get a hold of me at my email.
Yeah, okay.
I'll give you Derek. I'll give you his email after the show there if you want to phone me.
Okay, sounds good.
Sounds good.
Okay, you guys go ahead and talk.
I just have one more question I want to ask Bob, and then we're going to go to our end. And that was one of the questions I was going to ask, which Derek started out to be, is what are the difficulties of the veterans facing today? And you can just briefly just give us a prescription of what's going on. And
Say that one again.
The difficulties you're having today for the veterans. What are the difficulties the veterans are facing today?
Well, the difficulty we're having with veterans today is simple. I wish we had a few more minutes to go through this, but a good friend of mine who is an old Métis soldier from Ladysmith here down the road here told me, a fellow named George Ouellette told me a joke one time about the Métis, two Métis brothers going fishing. And both of them had two sealers, one in each hand, or one of each, and they had worms in the sealers. And when it was time to go for lunch, Jack put his fishing rod in the mud and put a stone against it. And he says, "Come on, Pierre." He said, "We're going to go down to have the dinner." And Pierre said, "Okay." So he stuck his fishing pole in the mud also and put a stone against it. But all this time, Jacques was putting the lid on the sealer and to hold the worms in. And when he was finished, Pierre turned and he was going on. He said, "Pierre," he says, "what's the matter with you?" He says, "You're going to lose all your worms." "Why?" He says, "Well," he says, "look at them." He says, "You didn't put the lid on." He says, "Oh," he says, "I don't need the lid." And Jack says, "Why don't you need the lid?" He says, "Well, those are Métis worms." He says, "What do you mean they're Métis worms?" "Well, look at," he said, "down into the sealer there." And he said, "see all those worms that are squirming about? And there's one that's trying to get up out the top." "Yeah." He says, "and the other ones, they're all pulling them back." He says, "they're Métis worms."
There you go. Well, thanks,
so anyways, Bob. That's what we're having trouble with is we're a lot of infighting, and fortunately, we have a lot of support from a lot of the Métis people, and hopefully that will go away.
That's great.
Thank you very much, Dale.
Thank you for being on our guest on the Métis Voices Radio program. It's been a pleasure to have you with us here. Thank you. I'd like to thank the sponsors for listening and tuning in to our show tonight. I'd like to thank the directors and sponsors of the BBS Radio for allowing us to present this program to you each week. Please send feedback about the Métis Voices Radio, located on the BBS Radio homepage. Column on the left-hand side, and also be sure to visit the museum website at www.metismuseum.org. Next week, Friday, July 4th, this program is the second part of the Residential School series that was first aired on Tuesday, June 24th on Between Two Worlds radio show. My guest will be Derek White Sky Cloud from Between Two Worlds program. We welcome all interest to call in and give us your stories and comments.
please visit us at our museum website at www.machif.org and our community site at the Machif Métis Museum .ing.com. Please tune in next time starting 7:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Have a good week. Take care. I'll see you again, Marcy. Thank you.
Get on.
I think we're off the air.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.